I'm 55 years old. Today is Thursday, May 13th, 2021. I am located in Denver. My recording partner is Anlan Du, who is my daughter.
Hi, I am said daughter. My name is Anlan Du. I'm 20. Today's date is also still Thursday, May 13th, and I'm coming out of Charlottesville, Virginia.
Well, it's nice to be able to chat online. I know you're in exams, and it's nice of you to make time. I know we always have good conversations, and it's nice to be able to have one in this medium with you.
Yep. I'm glad I get to talk to you. And I know that my mom, for all of you listening, is in the middle of like several different cases. She's been doing a lot of client work right now, so she's got all sorts of deadlines coming up, so it's a fun time for both of us right now. But I guess that sort of segues into my introduction of my mother, who's the main focus here, and just what do you do?
So I am a lawyer with a legal services organization, which is a nonprofit that provides free civil legal services to indigent people. We are statewide here in Colorado. So my project is a human trafficking project. So I represent human trafficking survivors in various ways, sometimes litigation, in other words, suing their traffickers, sometimes helping them to report their trafficking to law enforcement if that's something they would like to do. There's special visas for foreign nationals who are survivors of trafficking. So we do a lot of work on those visas and some other type of civil legal work, which means not being a prosecutor or a defense attorney, but working on other civil cases, again, statewide. And they are free legal services. In order to have staff, one of my roles is grant writing and grant management. So that's kind of an evolution in my work, but it's a big part of keeping us going.
And what about your side project, your Remain? Do you want to tell us about that?
So not trafficking related, but at the same time I was starting in legal services, I became involved in an immigration detention program that was just starting up. There's no sort of public defender system in immigration detention. So that was just a group of attorneys going out for free and trying to identify cases. This would be back in 1995 when I graduated from law school. So we incorporated, created a board, of course, and I was board president from 2000 to 2021. So on inauguration day, as it happens, that was my day when we met, and I stepped down after 20 years as board president. So it's a big part of my life. I am still on the board. Our work intersects a lot with my legal services work because they provide free legal services to immigrants, sometimes in trafficking cases as well. So we have a collaboration along with my being able to provide leadership there. So that's a lot about me. What would you like to say about yourself?
I'm just along for the ride. I am bearing witness to all of my mom's amazing accomplishments in legal aid, and just, you know, for the sake of posterity, the name of the nonprofit that my mom founded, as she's not saying, but she founded, is the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network. So maybe, you know, it's a pretty impressive organization. It's grown a lot, and especially in the wake of Trump's election. So it's been very fun to see that sort of grow from a small little office with five people to like a massive operation taking up multiple floors of a building. So it's been very, very exciting.
Well, that's kind of you. And sometimes they've been kind of like family to you because she grew up going to, you know, fundraisers and sometimes having to sit through meetings. So hopefully it's been some support for you in a weird way, just, you know, knowing a lot of people long term who always adored you and let you get away with you know, sneaking the fondue at the benefits and so forth. But you're more than along for the ride. You're very accomplished with a full scholarship at your college and long academic history. Anything more you want to say about your interests or?
Not particularly. I guess we can just jump right into it. Yeah, what led you to consider this work?
I will spare you my whole life story, but I think there were a couple of points at which my direction sort of steered toward this. I think it's kind of one of the earliest was that I had kind of a pause in college when I didn't quite know what I wanted to study and didn't quite want to be going to classes. So they didn't call it gap years then. But I dropped out basically and worked the third shift at a diner, which I won't name, but in my hometown, and it was rough work, very, very harsh bosses, and I think that sort of sparked my awareness of how workers are treated in this country, which I know I preach to you a lot. So probably ad nauseum, but that was a start. And then I was I grew up on the Canadian border and ended up in journalism for a few years. And I think being a journalist on the border just revealed to me so many different circumstances involving immigrants and immigrants who died trying to cross the border, immigrants who accidentally crossed the bridge to Canada. There's a river between Canada and Western New York, where I was, and very fast flowing river. So there's take the bridge or try to cross the fast running water. So there are some very just difficult situations that just made me aware of what people were doing to try to make a better life in this country. My clients now are not all immigrants, but many are, who have just made incredible sacrifices to try to make a better life for themselves and to support their families. And so that sort of was an awareness that started then. Finally, when I sort of became disenchanted with journalism. So just on a fluke, I took a job as a paralegal in South Georgia with a legal aid there, and that was in their farm worker division. And they were interested in somebody with a writing background, so to help with some of the written work. And I literally drove down there from Western New York for my interview, took a job there, and that office actually handled trafficking cases before there was human trafficking. So in the Southeast at the time, and still now to some extent, workers are recruited from homeless shelters. Often they're African American. Sometimes they have substance use issues. So they would be recruited to come work in the harvest season. And maybe they were paid with crack cocaine or with beer. They were charged for, you know, bologna sandwiches for lunch. And as a result, they ended up in debt. And so they were sort of trapped on these farms by sometimes violence or threats of violence, but also by these debts. And so they were totally manipulated into basically providing slavery-like labor. So that led to law school, and I think that my interest was solidified, and I've always had some focus on, and I focused my career on sort of that intersection of labor and immigration to a great extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's definitely been interesting to see how they're very interrelated issues, but they're obviously each have their own specific demographics of vulnerable populations. So I think we can see that a lot with your, you know, early career being focused on trafficking that maybe wasn't directly immigrant related. So what, in all that time, and I guess since then, what types of cases have, or are there specific cases that stand out to you as particularly meaningful?
There are a lot. I'll just focus on two. One was an early case at Colorado Legal Services involving a group of farm workers who were recruited to come from Mexico to work in the harvest in the U.S. There's a lot I remember about it. It was a very involved case. They were clients for, you know, good portion of 10 years in various regards. But there is a lot I learned from them. First of all, they came and, you know, a couple were in their 50s, one was in his 60s. They had experienced a lot of age discrimination in Mexico. So after a certain age, a lot of people just can't find work and they have families to support. So they took a chance. They took this, it's a crew boss, took the crew boss up on his offer to come here. And when they got here, he informed them, well, you owe this much for being smuggled in. You know, we charge you for rides to work. There was a very basic compound, almost like a barracks where they were housed, that didn't have fresh drinking water. It was gated. So that it was monitored. The crew boss carried a weapon. They were very isolated. And at the time that this arose, it really wasn't seen as trafficking. It was seen as, and trafficking meaning, you know, some sort of forced labor where the person feels they can't leave and they're compelled to provide work. That work could be commercial sexual services, you know, coerced or forced, or it could be other types of labor like farm work or restaurant work. So with these workers, we were able to hear about it and make contact. They were just so courageous in coming forward and reporting this when they were very fearful. And they did get these special visas and several became permanent residents here, which happens after this visa is granted a few years later. And we had brought a lawsuit, resulted in a $7.8 million judgment against the crew boss and a settlement against the grower. And it just, I think it's was an important case because it was an early case in the state, but also it is different from the stereotype of trafficking. I think when a lot of people think about human trafficking, they think about, you know, sex slaves and sort of a very sexualized view. And of course, sex trafficking does involve sex, but doesn't necessarily, it's more titillating, I guess you'd say. So the fact that this was trafficking and they did get the visas and did participate in a law enforcement investigation and being just not the general stereotype of trafficking, you know, mm-hmm. middle-aged men, farm workers, it's not the view. So I thought it's an important sort of public education case as well, or it helps in our community education, which is part of what we do.
Mm-hmm. And remember, that one was on the front page of the Denver Post at the time. So it definitely, I think, helped public awareness of this issue.
Well, thank you. And there are, unfortunately, there's a lot of that mistreatment all over the country. This was an early one in Colorado, as I said. But so many types of workers are just have these vulnerabilities in all kinds of industries, which I might talk about later. The second case was just kind of not as splashy, but it was interesting as well. And it just had a special I don't know, it just created a special bond, I guess, with the worker. So it was a couple years ago, and it was a woman who came as a household worker, a domestic worker. So a family was vacationing in the Colorado mountains. She came with them as their housekeeper and nanny, and it ended up being abusive. Her passport was withheld. She was working very long hours, earning the pay she would have earned in her home country, so not earning U.S. wages, but not always even earning that. And through just a chain of communications, we heard about her. And while we don't usually go to a situation where there might be trafficking, we had a very narrow window in which to meet with her. So I went to this mountain community, and somebody arranged for a meeting. And a lot of the time, the first thing I do is just talk about people's rights without sort of questioning them or imposing any expectations on them. Just like, this is who I am. This is what we do. This could be relevant to your situation. And it's always such an honor that people often really trust us. I don't see why they would, but you know, we talked about her rights. She then talked about her situation. And she really, really just wanted out. She wanted to get out of there. She couldn't take it. She was kind of demoralized by the treatment. And she was, you know, she was also in her 30s, so not a kid either, although we certainly have child clients. But anyway, the situation was the family was on an outing, and we were in this resort community. We kind of worked on a plan. We found support, a shelter where she could stay. We arranged for the local police to help with what's called a civil assist. So that is, they were going to come when the family returned and help her get her belongings, including her passport. So we were kind of there on the mountainside in this condo community, waiting for the family to get back and the police assistance. And so we just kind of talked, and she explained to me sort of how she came to be in the situation. She was widowed and had to support her children who were with her mother. So she sort of felt she didn't have a lot of options, so ended up spending years with this family, with all this exploitation. And I don't usually talk about myself to clients, but then she asked me if I was married, and I am a widow too, and at the time was widowed. So we kind of sat there like just relating to each other as two people who had been widowed and had to sort of carry on life after that. And just kind of sitting there in this very peaceful surroundings, yet in this very, you know, harsh situation, was just very, very memorable. We did end up getting her belongings with the support of the police. We later got, we later brought a lawsuit, and that was settled. She also received the special visa. And at like 10 o'clock at night, I drove her like 2 hours to a town where she was able to get shelter. And so it just, again, just, you know, it was a reminder of what leads to people being in these kinds of situations and how unfair it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's very poignant reminder that like it's a, you know, very sudden circumstances can change people's fate so dramatically. I also I remember hearing the entire time that you were handling that specific case how much you relied on like these interpersonal networks, like that's one person talking to another person talking to you, or even trying to find her a place to stay for the night after you'd gotten her out of that situation. Like there's it's really hard, it seems like, for people to come forward talking about the trust issue you were talking about when they know that someone else has their passport. Like the person, their exploiter has their passport, has all their documentation, and it's very it's like those small like person to person communications are just so vital to establishing trust and to getting people out of such circumstances. So
it really is. And it really cuts both ways. There can be, you know, loved ones who are totally exploiting a person, family members or somebody from the village. And then at the same time, there can be complete strangers who see something wrong, care, and do something about it. And that's always striking to me, the efforts some people will make for someone who was a stranger, you know, not long ago. But as to your point, yeah, networks are so important. And a lot of anti-trafficking work does involve sort of participation in different networks and informal networks.
Yeah, just that outreach bit. And I mean, talk about strangers sticking out their necks for each other. I remember you bringing home this client and just letting him stay in our basement for a night because he had nowhere else to be and he had to be on a train out of the state the next day. So yeah. It's definitely a very interpersonal, there's an interpersonal element to your job as well.
And for the record, I don't do that very often.
But I guess that's like an important reminder to all of us anyway, that, you know, just to keep our eyes out on situations. Like for me, I remember growing up, I was at this farmer's market one time and I just saw this kid who looked really sad and he was playing the violin with like, I don't know, a bucket for tips in front of him. And he just looked so sad. And I was like, I remember emailing up my mom and being like, I was at summer camp at the time. I remember emailing her and asking her, like, is this kid okay? Should we do something about this? And I don't think we ever really resolved that situation. But it's, you know, if there's something that seems sketchy, like, there are people to ask about it. Like, you can talk to the person themselves or you can reach out to a hotline. And that's, like, a very vital, as we just saw with all these stories, a very vital part of getting people connected with the resources that could help them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, I mean, it might be warped for you to have that perspective so young, but it is so important to be aware. And you've taken the focus a little deeper with your schoolwork as far as sort of societal issues that are the sort of the underpinnings of this.
I recently wrote a paper where I was just researching. So a lot of these cases, as you might have picked up, are cases that involve farm workers. And I did some research and realized just how much of those inequities and how much of the lack of protections that farm workers experience arise out of Jim Crow era laws. So specifically, going into the New Deal era, Southern Democrats, who were obviously very concerned about the slave labor that they were enjoying, even well into Jim Crow era, you know, under various other legal technicalities, but nonetheless, it was slave labor. They were very concerned about this. So when they were negotiating the passage of New Deal legislation, including the big name laws that we know about for labor protections, like the National Labor Relations Act and the
Fair Labor Standards Act.
Yes, the Fair Labor Standards Act. Just those, both of those, they were negotiating and they negotiated that farm workers and domestic workers who were disproportionately Black workers in the South would not be included in those protections. And so the very basis of the New Deal is this incredibly like racist, incredibly white supremacist economic structure of the South, and that remains today. Like those inequities have not been remedied. So on small farms, farm workers are still not entitled to minimum wage. They're also not entitled to overtime pay. Under the National Labor Relations Act, there continues to be no protection for farm workers to engage in organized labor at all. So it's just mind-boggling to see even now how safety regulations, how, you know, financial regulations, how organized labor protections, all of those just don't apply because Southern Democrats wanted to keep their source of exploited Black labor.
And that is carried over. That is carried over to other people of color, sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, in the 1940s, and well through World War One and Two, as there was a shortage of labor, the United States government actually engaged in negotiations with the Mexican government to bring Mexican Americans as temporary laborers and also full-time laborers. So that we saw this massive demographic shift, but nonetheless, it's always been this like deep like issue of racial exploitation. But it's fascinating. I know you hate the word intersectionality because it's overused these days, but it is a very poignant reminder that like labor issues are not race blind. They are not issues of like what they're not issues that affect everyone equally. And when we talk about reforms, they will disproportionately impact certain groups. And I think that's an important thing to bear in mind is like labor rights are Black rights and are Mexican American rights and are immigrant rights.
And of course, we're talking a bit about trafficking, and that's part of it. You know, there are all kinds of abuses, but these lack of protections contribute to an atmosphere where trafficking can be happening.
Yeah. What are some other ways that you've seen what are vulnerable conditions that you've seen people be targeted for, maybe?
Yeah. Sorry, my audio seems to be getting choppy at times, which again normally doesn't happen. I like to say that, and I probably say it a lot with my community education, but you know, traffickers are just masterminds at finding people's vulnerabilities and then exploiting them. And there are just so many different vulnerabilities. And I think it's important to focus on just the fact that there are vulnerabilities and that people are being exploited because of them, rather than focusing on one type of vulnerability. So for example, obviously poverty is an issue, especially if somebody doesn't have a place to live. They're very vulnerable, or they're fleeing, you know, they're trying to escape from poverty in their region of the U.S. or in another country. So they're sort of migrating as a result of poverty. People who have been victimized previously, maybe they already have a lot of trauma in their backgrounds, and or they're fleeing an abusive situation, and the traffickers take advantage of that. Could be people with disabilities who either might not recognize that trafficking is happening, or might not know, you know, be able to articulate it real well, or know how to respond to it. Or there have been cases where the disability is, an addiction issue, kind of like what I mentioned earlier. And they're sort of bound because of their addictions. Certainly immigration status is a factor that of course we see a lot, but that happens everywhere. It could be somebody without status who is just fearful of speaking up because of fear of deportation, which has happened, that, you know, deportation and retaliation for asserting their rights. But it also can be a worker present on a visa, like this housekeeper was here with permission, but cannot, the visa requires them to stay with a certain employer. So they cannot switch jobs without falling out of immigration status. So that serves to keep them in their jobs as well. Also, you know, again, lack of education certainly can be a factor, just not being informed about different systems or laws, youth status, somebody, especially if a young person has left a difficult family situation, they might be treated as a runaway. They might not feel comfortable coming forward and reporting abuses. There are just so many different ways that people have vulnerabilities. And at different points in life, it could have been, you know, many of us who have had these vulnerabilities. So it's very sad, you know, again, that people do that to other people. Often, you know, somebody they're actually familiar with or, you know, related to or have known for a long time. I don't know. Do you have thoughts?
No, I think that sums it up pretty well. I definitely have heard a lot about how, from you, about how people sort of conceptualize all trafficking as sex trafficking. And obviously that's a significant portion, but it's an active stigma or an active generalization that you have to work to overcome and teach people to like recognize it in other areas too. I guess like, if you have other, what are some other challenges you see in working in this field, either on the public education side or the actual like legal side?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there are misconceptions about trafficking. I think there tends to be a focus on sex trafficking, as you said, especially of youths. And you know, rather than labor trafficking. And I'm not saying labor trafficking is more important. It's just, it happens to be a lot of what I have done. And sometimes I, especially in the early days, I was, might've been the only voice in the room, so to speak, focusing on labor trafficking. So it's certainly a big part of what I do. So there's still misconceptions. In the last few years, there are major challenges as the systems, especially the immigration systems, sort of constricted. So policies that encourage people to report crimes, including trafficking, basically from 2000 to 2017 or 18, you know, the systems encouraged people to report crimes. So there was not a practice of deporting people if they applied for one of these visas and were denied. And that all changed, you know, 2017, 2018, where suddenly there was a change in policy saying people could be deported if their visa was denied, and changing processing in many, many ways, being harsher in the processing, adding new requirements, sometimes sort of arbitrarily, or just the laws were being interpreted much more narrowly, or the eligibility was being interpreted much more narrowly. So those were big changes, and not a lot of labor trafficking prosecutions during that time. There never are a lot of labor trafficking prosecutions, but there was a drop off and more visa denials. And the visas are not a reward for or a quid pro quo for reporting a crime, including trafficking. It is to promote public safety. It's to protect all of us if people are comfortable reporting crimes without fearing deportation or fearing being jailed as a runaway or something, you know, detained as a runaway or something. We all feel safer. In the LGBTQ community, there was that issue of feeling more of a hostile climate and perhaps more reluctance to report crimes. So the visas and the systems should be geared toward encouraging people to report crimes and helping them to stabilize. But certainly it's not simply, it's not at all a trade-off for reporting these crimes.
Yeah. So it sounds like there's just been a lot of barriers in the in just getting cases to be settled and to getting cases. I also remember you talking about how cases have started taking so much longer. Like it take client can be in limbo for years, just waiting to hear about their status and just waiting for their case to be reviewed.
That is true. We did get a T visa at one point, and not that long ago, maybe 6 years ago, it came in 2 months. And now it can take, you know, more than 2 years, sometimes less, but it can take even more than 2 years with no right to work while that's pending. So somebody continues to be without status, without authorization to work, and so further vulnerable to abuse and exploitation while they're trying to remedy the earlier exploitation or trafficking. So it's just such an irony that it has gotten that way.
Yeah, it is. Well, to end on a more cheerful note, what do you think? We talked about the sort of negative changes or the recent hardships, but what do you think has improved? What do you think has gotten better?
Yeah, there's been a lot. And remember, you know, when I first got involved in this type of work, it wasn't even called trafficking, you know, with the worker cases in the Southeast. It was debt bondage, which wasn't really even a federal crime at the time. But now under the trafficking laws, debt bondage is a form of trafficking. So meaning being forced to continue working to pay off a debt when you're never actually paying off that debt. It might even be increasing. So certainly I was around for the passage of the law, for one thing, in 2000, the anti-trafficking laws. So that was a change. But over since then, there's just more advocates involved. There are more people who can help provide services. Overall, it's a real patchwork around the country. So in some states, there are a number of people providing services. Other states, not as many, but overall an increase. More legal aides are handling trafficking cases. More people are bringing these lawsuits, whether it's big firms donating their services or, again, legal aides. So trying to really seek compensation from a victim or for a victim from the trafficker. So that's a real positive. The collaborations have really grown. So for example, in our state, under state law, in 2014, a state council was created to address certain, to make recommendations to regarding services, to try to quantify trafficking or at least assess trafficking prevalence in Colorado. You know, they've been meeting monthly since 2014. It's a very stable group, bringing a lot of perspectives. And again, the labor perspective tends to be in the minority, but there's been real growth. And as an example, there was there's been a public awareness campaign that's using little vignettes about cases, and it's a very broad range of potential cases. You know, youth and sales crews, or a farm worker for sure, a young woman sort of like wooed and then, you know, offered help and then ended up having to sell sex against her will. So a whole range of vignettes, which is a very broad view of trafficking. And I'm actually really proud of this council for doing that.
Yeah. And it's, I guess that's the perfect place to end is with this council. Just, you know, it's amazing to see how there's this state recognition of trafficking as a broad issue and telling stories on such an individual level. And I'm sure it's a great honor to be a part of that council.
Yeah, and they are receptive to the different voices, and including mine, and I'm sometimes an outlier, but it's been very inclusive. I was able to serve on that particular committee, which, while still happening, So that committee that worked on the public awareness, there was a lot of attention also, I should say, to not being super sensational. So these vignettes are pretty factual. They're from the first person perspective. So it's not sort of racializing the victim. So it's very positive.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we got to, you know, it's as a part of that storytelling, I'm glad that we got to talk to you, someone on the more legal side and on the representative side. Personally, growing up, I've just always been very lucky to have such an outstanding role model in my life. But, you know, I always joke with my friends that, like, I'm never going to be do as much morally righteous work for this world as my mom has. And so those are big footprints to follow, but it's, you know, it's really exciting to get to share that with the world. So.
Well, thank you. I'm certainly not fishing for compliments, but you don't know where your path will lead. And I didn't know where my path would lead. So it's just a matter of sort of, following your path and following your interests.
Yeah. Well, thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you. You've got
two. This is so formal.
You have two exams today, so
yes.
Thank you for taking the time.
And signing off.